court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Court appointed. Two dudes perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, howdy there, partner.
Yeehaw! Round up them little doggies.
So you might be able to guess from our introductions.
We're going to head back to the old west and rustle you up a case of legal matters to sink your teeth into, partners.
That's right. This whole week I've been practicing on my cowboying. I've been practicing my riding, my roping, and my pancake eating.
And you're steering?
My steering. I'm steering my car all over the road.
Well, we're both big fans of the Western and the Old West days.
Absolutely. And, I think you probably help instill that.
Probably so.
In me a little bit.
When you were growing up, I made you sit and watch repeatedly with me the best movie ever made, bar none. Not just the best Western, although it is the best Western, but the best movie of all time, although I know I get a lot of pushback and a lot of other exceptions, but I don't care. It's my pick, and it's our show, and I'm going to say it. Outlaw Josie Wales.
It's a great movie.
The best movie ever made.
I don't know if I'm going to go as far as you and say it's the best movie ever made, but it is definitely in my top 10, probably top 5. I love that movie. I mean, I could sit and watch it over and over and over again. It's got everything. It's got action. It's got comedy.
Adventure.
Adventure. True love.
It's got everything there is. Male bonding.
Yeah.
The scene where Clint Eastwood meets with Tin Bears.
Yes.
With Josie Wales and Tin Bears.
We could probably do a whole podcast episode just on that movie.
Oh, yeah. And there's so many great lines in that.
Yes.
He tells Tin Bears, he says, dying's easy. It's living that's hard for folks like you and me after everything we've ever loved has been butchered or raped.
Yes.
Yeah, he brings it. I mean, it is great.
Well, we're going to endeavor to persevere and keep moving on about the Wild West trial.
You going to pull them pistols or whistle Dixie?
This podcast is just going to be Josie Wales quotes, just outlaw Josie Wales quotes.
Well, that rock candy's not for eating. It's for looking through.
So we decided we want to do a Wild West episode and talk about maybe some sort of Wild West trial.
And so when we did our research looking for a famous moment in history that had a trial associated with it or legal matters, surprisingly enough, gunfight at the OK Corral popped up.
I had no idea that there was actually a trial because the movies always end at the gunfight.
Yeah, and you think these guys are marshals or sheriffs or whatever they are. I mean, my impression, not really paying that close of attention, is Wyatt Earp was the marshal and the other ones were his deputies and they went in and cleaned up the town. But that wasn't quite the whole story. And that we're going to be like Paul Harvey and we're going to give you the rest of the story because after the gunfight, the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday actually were put on trial for murder.
That's true. So a little backstory about the whole battle gunfight at the OK Corral. There's been a lot of movies about it through the ages. A couple in the 90s, I think.
Oh, lots of different versions, a lot of fantasy versions of it, more or less. But we're here to tell you the real hard, cold facts.
As we've researched them.
That's right.
So just some brief backstory. Tombstone is in Arizona. And it was a gold rush town. So basically, one of those type towns that just popped up out of nowhere. And this was back in probably about 1877, 1880. And that's when the Tombstone really started to kind of boom.
Had a silver rush.
Was it silver rush or
they
gold rush?
They found silver.
Oh, silver. There's silver in those hills.
Yeah, and they had 400 people living there. And 2 years later, there was 7,000 people living there.
That's quite a boom.
They all rushed there. And when they first started showing up, the soldiers warned them, said the only rock you're going to find in that place is Tombstone. And that's how it got its name.
Huh. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So Wyatt Earp, who is the protagonist in a lot of the movies, and we're not going to say he's a protagonist here since he was...
Well, he's a hero in the movies. The protagonists are the Clantons and the McLaurys.
What do you mean?
Well, they're the protagonists are the ones that start the trouble, right?
No, the protagonist is the hero. They're the... Oh. That's the antagonist is the bad person.
Oh, okay. Well, I stand corrected. It's a good thing you know all them big words.
So...
Why don't you just say the bad guy and the good guy? I know what that means.
So...
The good guy is Wyatt Earp.
So the good guy in the movies is Wyatt Earp and his brothers. They are good.
I don't know. Protagonist sounds bad, but antagonist sounds worse. So
anyway, I don't feel comfortable calling him the good guy in this since we're trying to take an unbiased approach to it.
This is true.
So Wyatt Earp and his brothers, they came to Tombstone. Wyatt Earp had been a lawman and had made a name for himself in Dodge City, Kansas. And he and his brothers came to town and they wanted to kind of make some money and try to prosper in this in the boomtown. And they had a buddy there who moved there soon about the same time as them. His name was Doc Holliday.
And the brothers were Virgil and Morgan.
And so they all moved there. They basically started kind of opening up different businesses. And Wyatt had acquired a 25% interest in a Faro game at the Oriental Saloon. And Faro is a interesting kind of game. I think you had done some research about that. It's not poker.
Right. I just assumed it was a different name for poker. And it actually originated in France. Basically, it's a matching type game where you have like they would put down a suit of cards that were like glued to a board. And then you place chips, kind of like poker chips, on these different cards and bet in different ways. And then the dealer would pull cards from what they called a box, or sometimes I've heard it referred to as a shoe, mm-hmm. and they would pull cards out, and you'd pull out two cards, and one was the dealer card, and one was the player card. And if you hit the player card, you won, and if they pulled the dealer card, you lost, and the other bets rode. And there's some other things on there that other ways to play it where you could split some and some things like that, but it gets complicated, but I don't think they do it anymore. But evidently, that was the preeminent card game from about 1825 to 1910, there was more people playing Faro than there was poker.
So basically, I remember from the movie Tombstone, Doc Holliday makes a quote about it. And says he's talking about he's got a business interest in the Faro game at the Oriental. He says, "Since when's Faro business?"
Well, there was a lot of cheating that was associated with it, going both ways, whether you were a player or a dealer. But the reason I think that most gambling establishments switched to poker is poker was more in the favor of the house.
That's right.
And Faro did not favor anybody. It was pretty much a straight-up game. So that's why a lot of the houses, they started cheating, and they developed different types of boxes that you could cheat with where you could see cards ahead of time to hedge your bets and some things like that and practice sleight of hand to pull two cards at a time instead of one and some things.
So in that movie Tombstone, he goes, Doc says to Wyatt, "Since when is Faro a business?" Wyatt says, "Didn't you always say gambling is an honest trade?" Doc says, "No, I said poker is an honest trade. Only suckers buck the tiger. The odds are all in the house."
And you know why they called it Buck the Tiger?
Why is that?
The most popular cards that were used at the time had a tiger displayed on the back. You know how the backs are always ornamental.
Oh, really?
Of it. And it was a tiger. I don't remember what the brand name was, but that was their emblem. So that's what they often called it, was bucking the tiger.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, our research takes us most anywhere. You don't know what might turn up. And I love trivia, so I love learning useless facts. My mind is filled with useless facts. I don't have any ones that make any matter to anything, but I do have a lot of useless ones.
Well, that's part of our mantra is we're going to help you win some bar trivia sometimes.
There you go.
the Earps, they basically come to town. They were kind of starting up trying to make their fortune.
Yeah, they were there for business. Right. They weren't there because they were conscientious lawmen following bad guys and wanting to clean up the town. They were there to make money.
Right.
And they were kind of dubious, in fact, because they kind of proclaimed themselves lawmen sometimes because they were willing to use their guns, whereas a lot of people may not have been so proficient at it.
Right.
So, but they were not great characters. They were bullies.
No, they were PG-13 kind of guys. Not quite rated R guys, but they're probably PG-13 guys.
And at the time, Virgil was the only one that was actually a lawman.
That's true. Yeah, he was actually a U.S. Marshal for, I think, what?
Yeah, Deputy Marshal, yeah, I think. Marshal. Yeah, and Wyatt and Morgan, they were not anything official at the time. Now, Wyatt tried to run for sheriff, but got defeated by that guy named Behan.
Right. And boy, he was painted as a real coward in the Tombstone movie.
Yeah. Yeah. But this whole town was kind of out of control.
Yeah.
There was a lot of lawlessness, a lot of drinking, gambling, and of course, as our episode there a couple weeks ago, the red light district.
That's right.
It prospered greatly there.
So the other side of the faction of this gunfight, the OK Corral, was a group called the Cowboys. Cowboys kind of was this article we researched said it was a pejorative term, which means it was a bad term.
It's a disparaging term.
Yes. And that meant that you were somebody who basically was kind of a roughneck and you wrestled horses and engaged in some sort of law breaking. So it was really kind of a bad thing to call somebody a cowboy.
Gunplay and tomfoolery.
Tomfoolery.
Yeah, I've never heard of people being referred to as cowboys being a bad thing, but in those days, at that time, if you were referred to as a cowboy, you were basically a bad guy, a criminal.
The story that the facts that lead up to it, it was basically about the time Virgil was a lawman, and he had asked Wyatt and Morgan to help him hunt down some horse thieves who had stolen some mules from an army outpost. And so basically they went on and they, I guess, formed their own little posse. And they found the mules at a McLaury ranch with U.S. brand change to D8. And Frank McLaury reacted angrily to the Earp's intervention in the case and considered them to be acting as citizens rather than as lawmen and told them to stay away from him and his operations. So that kind of that was one of the first things that kind of ticked off the little war between these two factions. As you alluded to earlier, there was also a rivalry between Wyatt Earp and Johnny Behan. Behan being, I guess, the one he ran against Sheriff. And there's also kind of a dispute between, not a dispute between the two, but they were both trying to win the affections this lady named Josephine Marcus. So actually she had dated Behan at first or lived with him a period of time, but eventually she left Behan and took up with Wyatt.
So they were running for the same job and they were vying for the same lady.
Yes.
That is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, that's the triangle of disaster. So the sheriff's race eventually, well, Wyatt got the girl, Behan got the job.
There you go.
that's how that shook out.
The governor came down on Behan's side, and the governor intervened and helped him out.
That's according to history.
Right, and the town was kind of split. Half the town wanted Behan, and the other half wanted Earp. And that's kind of the way they were, but half the town was bad, and the other half was wanting it cleaned up. So and Behan was kind of on the side of the Cowboys, the yes. bad guys, not the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, who are still the bad guys, too. Sorry for any Cowboys fans out there.
Well, it won't matter this Sunday.
No, it's true. So there was a couple other things. There was a major stagecoach robbery where somebody got off with $26,000, which, I mean, had to have been just a fortune back then.
Oh, yeah. Could have retired on that, probably.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. Yeah. I don't know what the conversion would be in today's present-day dollars, but it had to be quite a bit of money.
I would think so.
But there was two different posses that kind of went after the people who did this. One was the Earp posse, and one was the Behan posse. And that you know, there's two competing sides in this town.
And they both wanted to catch the people.
Yep.
Because it was a high-profile robbery. And they thought if they got it, then, you know, Earp thought he could turn the tide and maybe he could then become the marshal there. So he was hoping, or the sheriff, so he was hoping that he could be the one to do it. And I thought it was interesting when they got together their posse. Did you catch the name of one of the people that was in their posse?
Was it Bat Masterson?
Yes, Bat Masterson. Have you ever heard that name before?
Only I've heard it. I know he's like some sort of famous Western guy, and I know he was... was he like an actor too in some of the silent movies?
No, but see where that's coming in. There was an old TV series,
mm-hmm.
Bat Masterson.
Oh, really?
And it was about him. And I remember it when I was a kid. Now, I thought I must have watched it as a kid, but when I went back and looked it up, it ran from 58 to 61.
Mm.
Now, I was around then since I was born in 58, However, I don't think I remembered shows from then, so I must have seen reruns.
Well, it's like me watching I Dream of Jeannie or Bewitched.
Yeah. When I read that Pat Masterson, he was real. I just thought that was a TV show. So then I had to read about it. Bat Masterson was actually born in Canada and migrated down here and worked his way out west. But he was actually a good guy. I mean, he was there. He was a lawman. He was also involved in something similar to that. He was involved in a love triangle with a woman, and he was vying for a job back in Dodge City, Kansas. And he was vying for the sheriff's job with a guy, and they actually got in a shootout. And in the shootout, he shot the other guy, and that guy, as he was going down, shot at Bat Masterson and missed, but hit the girl of their affections and killed her. So Bat Masterson got the sheriff's job, but he lost his girl in the exchange. He did get shot as well. The bullet went through her and hit him.
Oh, wow.
And so he walked with a limp. So in that TV show, they always displayed the guys. A guy named Gene Barry played the part. And he always walked with a cane. And that's because Bat Masterson had a distinctive limp after that from where that bullet had lodged in his pelvis. And he walked with a cane. So they played that up. Now, the character in the TV show was nothing like the real-life guy. But he came out there to Tombstone and joined up with Wyatt Earp. At the time, he was on his side and helped him in a couple of things that they did. But everything I read, Bat Masterson was a pretty good guy.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I'd heard the name before, but I didn't know really why or where. So.
Well, it's strange. And a couple of these guys, as you'll see, we go along. This guy comes down from Canada. He wasn't a Western guy. You know, he came down from Canada and ended up out there, I guess, with the Silver Rush and everything that was going on. This was after the Civil War, and people were trying to make their stake. There was a lot of damage back east. People were moving out west. That was a new territory and a place to, you know, make your fortune. And we had several others that came out there that you'll hear later. They came from New York, and they're out west as big Western gunfighters, and they came from New York.
So Ike Clanton was one of the guys who was one of the cowboys, and around the story, the legend, or as the facts go, October 25th, 1881, he came to town, and he was basically making threats against the Earps and Doc Holliday. He was also carrying a rifle. Now, it's important because there was a local town ordinance in Tombstone at that time which said you were prohibited from carrying firearms in public places. They basically disarmed him and took his rifle from him, and he was fined $25, and he was allowed to leave without his rifle. So they basically said, hey, give us a rifle. There's a $25 fine. Get out of here.
Yeah, but it wasn't that simple. They clubbed him in the head with their pistols and took the rifle from him and dragged him into the sheriff's office. And the sheriff then kept his rifle and fined him the $25.
Well, that's an Old West taser.
So they roughed him up a little bit just to kind of set everything in motion.
You know, if you got some guy like that who's making threats and he's got a rifle in his hand, I mean, you take care of, you know, yourself. At least they didn't shoot the guy.
No, they didn't shoot him.
So, I mean, they might have been.
They pistol whipped him.
Well, you know.
And they called it, there was some colorful term they used for it. He buffaloed him when he saw him. That's what they called that. When you hit him in the head with a gun, you buffalo him.
It's like getting hit with a buffalo, I guess.
I guess. I don't know. It's like it's a horn sticking out of your head when you hit with a gun. I don't know. It's you buffaloed him.
Never heard that term before. So they took his rifle. They let him leave. He paid a $25 fine. So basically, Clanton goes and gets some of his buddies. Frank McLaury, who's one of the McLaurys we had mentioned earlier, and a guy named Billy Clanton. They heard about the way the brothers had kind of treated Ike, and they went down to a gun shop, and they loaded up their bullets into their gun belts, and they headed to the place called the OK Corral. So, and that was the famous shootout, the OK Corral.
So you had Frank and Tom McLaury, and you had Billy and Ike Clanton.
That's right, the Clans and McLaurys. So Sheriff Behan, who was the adversary or the foil to Wyatt Earp, he basically found out about the situation, and he went down to where they were at the OK Corral, and he said, hey, you got to disarm yourself. And he really tried to convince them to disarm themselves because he didn't want to have, supposedly didn't want to have a fight, knew something bad was going to happen if he didn't disarm themselves. Because he knew the Earps probably weren't going to back down from a fight. They said no. They said, we're not getting rid of our arms.
Yeah, they had already made statements that they wanted a fight. Yeah. They were waiting for it.
So Behan leaves, and he comes up, and he sees the three Earp brothers and Doc Holliday, and they're walking down towards the OK Corral because they're going to go down there and disarm these guys because they're basically breaking the town ordinance of carrying a firearm. And Behan, and this is kind of comes into play a little bit later, Behan tells him, he goes, I've disarmed them all, so don't worry about it. So the Earps, they still keep going down. They're just like, okay, you disarmed them, we're still going to go down there. You know, whether or not they believe the guy or not, like, well, we'll check it out for ourselves. We don't really trust you, Behan. Now they get down there. Story goes that they're about 10 feet from the Clantons and McLaurys, and they stopped. And then allegedly Virgil raised his walking stick with his right hand and shouted, and this is one of the versions, says, boys, throw up your hands. I want your guns. And then seconds later, shots started firing.
Well, and I like the way that Wyatt Earp put it when they asked him about it. He said, after a few seconds, the words of Wyatt Earp said, the shooting became general.
Yeah.
In other words, they were all shooting in every which way. They had no idea what was happening. How many shots did you shoot? I don't know. It just became general.
Oh, it's excitement. I lost count.
So how many was it, punk?
So the fallout, after it took about 30 seconds, and then the fallout was Frank McLaurie was fatally wounded with a bullet through his head. Billy Clanton was hit in the chest and was dying in the vacant lot. And Tom McLaurie was mortally wounded with a load of Doc Holliday's buckshot. Ike Clanton basically escaped into a house, and I think it was some sort of photography type house. Doc Holliday, Virgil, and Morgan were all injured with hip, leg, shoulder wounds, respectively. Wyatt Earp was unharmed.
He emerged unharmed, except for his coat. There was a load of buckshot went through the tail of his coat, but it didn't hit him.
Yep. So after this happens, Behan comes up and says to the group, he goes, I'm arresting you for murder.
Wyatt would have none of it.
Yeah, allegedly Wyatt goes, I won't be arrested. And then Behan just walked off. Later on, there was a statement by Behan that said that they had done right when they shot and killed the guys. But that kind of comes out a little bit later because there's some testimony in the trial. So as you can imagine, this was like all the talk of the town.
Oh, the next day, the newspaper ran a story noting that the 26th of October, 1881, will always be marked as one of the crimson days in the annals of Tombstone, a day when blood flowed as water and human life was held as a shuttlecock. I don't know what that means.
Well, I know a shuttlecock is used in badminton.
Yeah, I know, but is that what he means there?
Maybe.
And just they have badminton in those days?
I don't know. Maybe they were. It's a metaphor for life going back and forth. Like a game.
A shuttlecock.
Mongo only pawn in Game of Life.
So, well, now we're mixing movies.
Yeah.
That's a Blazing Saddles reference.
It's still Old West, though.
kind of.
So,
according to Mel...
screw you. We work for Mel Brooks. Yeah. So they had a funeral for the slain men, the McLaurys and the Clantons. And there was a pretty good crowd that watched it take place.
Yeah, they had 2,000 people showed up to watch from the sidewalks as it went by. So it's like these guys were well known, and they had, you know, like I say, about half the town was on their side.
Yep. So after the shootout, the coroner, he opened a formal inquest, which I guess back in that day was, you know, the coroner's report tell you basically what happened. And so he examined him, and I guess the coroner took testimony from people, too, and listened to, you know, stories about what happened, which is, I think, kind of different than what coroners do here in this day and age. The coroner's report said, William Clanton, Frank, and Thomas McLaurie came to their deaths in the town of Tombstone on October 26, 1881, from the effects of pistol and gunshot wounds inflicted by Virgil Earp, Morgan Earp, Wyatt Earp, and one Holliday, commonly called Doc Holliday.
Well, that took a lot of investigative research to come up with that, huh?
Yeah.
He basically, they probably glamorized that. I think what he probably walked out and said, he killed them.
Yeah.
They killed the some bitches.
That could also be called passing the buck. Yeah. Which.
The buckshot?
Yeah. Which we'll see actually to happen again, because the day after the coroner released that report, Ike Clanton filed first degree murder charges against the Earps and Holliday. Now, Ike Clanton was not a lawman. He was the other guy who escaped the OK shootout without being killed.
Yeah, he ran off.
So the interesting thing is that it doesn't really take place in this day and age. I mean, in some states it might. But at the time, any citizen could file a criminal complaint against somebody. in this day and age, generally only police officers or sworn officers are allowed to do that. And so they, you know, basically police officers do the same thing. They fill out a criminal complaint. But at that day and age, I guess, you know, they could do it. Anybody can do it. In fact, in West Virginia, I think it was not changed. I don't know when it was changed, but at some point in West Virginia, you could do that too. The citizen could file a criminal complaint.
So if somebody was killed, not necessarily the law enforcement people, but just a general person could go in and file a murder charge?
That's right. So the case went before the Justice of the Peace, Wells W. Spicer. And Justice of the Peace is another term for judge, kind of a, I guess, an archaic term. They don't really have Justice of the Peace anymore. I think West Virginia used to have Justice of the Peace system, but they got rid of that and replaced it with a magistrate system. Mm-hmm. But a Justice of the Peace is basically like kind of a lower level type judge who would hear smaller issues and also conduct preliminary hearings.
I think at that time they probably traveled around too. It wasn't like they were just in that one town. They traveled around and covered an area.
Oh, absolutely. I you know, probably some more of the rural places in West Virginia, they might travel. Well, they used to travel probably a little bit too, but in this day and age, there's usually a common courthouse they go to. After the murder criminal complaint was filed, it became Judge Spicer's job to determine whether the evidence indicated sufficient cause to believe the defendant's guilty of the crime of murder. And this is, and this typically is called a preliminary hearing. And generally, preliminary hearings are just to determine whether or not there's probable cause of the crime, that the crime was committed.
So there's no jury in a preliminary hearing?
No, there's no jury. It's just before the judge. In West Virginia, if you're arrested, and this is for felony charges, you have to have a preliminary hearing within 10 days if you're incarcerated, 20 days if you are actually out. The preliminary hearing is essentially, in this day and age, a chance for the prosecutor, basically the prosecution puts on their case in front of the justice of the peace or the magistrate, whoever, and demonstrate probable cause for the crime that had been committed. You know, it's not really that big of a deal. It's a good chance for the defense to kind of get some testimony from the state and determine and kind of lock them into whatever testimony they're going to be giving later on, because that's whatever, they're under oath and they're sworn. So basically they can't say one version here and then go and change it sometime later. So that's usually what it's good for.
And then they pass it on to a regular jury trial.
That's right. You know, it could be bound over to a grand jury who determines whether or not to indict them on the charges.
But so, the Earps and their lawyer thought they had a better chance handling it there, huh?
That's right. They decided they wanted to make this preliminary hearing the actual real trial. They felt that they'd rather have their fate decided by Judge Spicer in this preliminary hearing rather than by a jury of their peers who could be random people who might favor the Clans and McLaurys rather than the Earps.
Well, I guess basically what they're saying is they were going to try to demonstrate enough evidence where they would acquit them and say there's not enough evidence to indict these people.
Exactly. And that's exactly what they did. This preliminary hearing, and it took place instead of basically the regular trial. There were 30 witnesses with full cross-examinations by attorneys for both sides. And it's actually the longest preliminary hearing in Arizona history, and it lasted 1 month.
Now, I think the Earp brothers were pretty smart, though. They brought in a really high-class guy as their lawyer to represent them, a guy named Thomas Fitch.
And who was he?
As their lawyer, and this guy was hooked up. I mean, he knew stuff. He was well-educated. He became a congressman and a senator. He helped get Abraham Lincoln elected as president. He campaigned for him heavily, got him elected as president. He was friends with the Big Four that brought about the Transcontinental Railroad. He was there when the first rail was laid, and he was there at Promontory Point when the last rail was laid on the Transcontinental Railroad. I mean, this guy was hooked up.
He was friends of Collis P., right?
Collis P. Huntington, yeah.
Namesake for our fair city.
Yeah. Leland Stanford, Collis P. Huntington, Mark Hopkins, and Charles Crocker. Huh. And they're the ones that basically built half of the Transcontinental Railroad. This guy just seemed to show up. He was a senator and congressman for several different states. You know, somebody that makes you wonder, the Earps got him as their lawyer. And then you look at this group that was assembled for the Clantons and the McLaurys.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it was not the dream team with Johnny Cochran on their side. They got three guys and they were all kind of at odds with each other. So it did not look well for them.
Yeah. Well, the testimony started and it was behind closed doors, which is an interesting thing, too. I guess the defense had requested that on October 31st, 1881. And they had the coroner come up, and he basically testified that all the men were killed by pistol gunshot or pistol wounds, and that Tom McGlory's wounds indicated that he'd been killed by a shotgun rather than a revolver. So, you know, they at least had identified that was a bit more precise than his report. That was, you know, this is who got killed by the buckshot.
And, you know, that was Ike Clanton's shotgun that he shot him with, the one that they had disarmed him from earlier. Doc Holliday carried it down there to shoot him with his own gun.
Yeah, that's some sort of special achievement unlocked on Xbox, I think. So then the prosecution called a guy named Billy Allen. He basically told the court that when he told Frank McLaury that his brother Tom had been hit in the head by Wyatt Earp, he appeared in shock and said, "I'll get those boys out of town." And later, Allen allegedly heard Earp say out loud, "You sons of bitches, you've been looking for a fight." And at the same time, Virgil Earp ordered Clanton and McLaury's to throw your hands up. So basically, his testimony was the Earps came down there kind of aggravating the situation rather than trying to act in their job, the role as police officers, law officers. The interesting thing is Fitch basically cross-examined him, and he started asking him questions about his past, like asking him about crimes he committed in Colorado, and didn't he flee to Tombstone to avoid his past, and is he using an alias? And he just refused to answer it. So basically what he did is he kind of impeached him. And that's a technique used at trial to reduce somebody's credibility is you impeach them. You show that they might not be a good person or might not be trustworthy.
Or have some benefit from testifying one way or another.
That's right. The next day, they called one of the main guys in the story, Sheriff John Behan. He said that basically when he first learned of the trouble that was a brewing, that he was sitting in a barber chair and he had asked the barber that to please hurry up and get through.
So this big gunfight's going to take place and he's so concerned about it, but he's going to go ahead and finish getting his hair cut or his beard trimmed or whatever it was.
Well, the man's got style. So and then he said that he wanted to go out and disarm the parties. When he was out there trying to disarm McLaury, that basically he was interrupted when he spotted the Earps coming down the street. He told the Earps that he had been down there for the purpose of arresting and disarming the Clantons and the McLaurys, and he ordered the Earps to stop. He said, "I'm the sheriff of the county, and I'm not going to allow any trouble if I can help it." And Behan said basically that the Earps said, okay, and kept on walking. And then Behan said that he heard Wyatt say, "You sons of bitches been looking for a fight, and now you have it," about the same time Virgil ordered to throw your hands up. So that kind of comports with the previous statement of that Billy Lane.
And he also said, which I thought was funny, he thought, although I will not say for certain, the first shot being fired at Billy Clanton by Doc Holliday. Now, this was by sound. He didn't witness it. It was by sound. He thought that Doc Holliday shot at Billy Clanton first. How do you identify that by sound?
So, again, Fitch starts cross-examining Sheriff Behan, and he's trying to establish possible bias that he might have. He's asking him, you know, wasn't Wyatt your competition for the position of sheriff? And
Josephine Marcus?
Well,
the girl?
He says he didn't ask him those questions. That definitely would have been something I would have asked, probably.
Yeah.
His main focus of Behan's description of the shooting concerned the testimony that the first shot probably came from a nickel-plated pistol in Holliday's hand. Other witnesses basically said that Holliday was holding the shotgun. So how did he shoot with the nickel-plated pistol first if he was holding the shotgun?
He was talented.
Well, I'm sure he was.
He was very quick.
Also, this goes back to basically where Behan allegedly had said, told Virgil Earp that you did perfectly right after the gunfight.
Yeah, Virgil was wounded, and while they were tending to his wounds, he went to him and was comforting him and telling him, you did right. And there was a lot of witnesses to that effect.
Right. And then the prosecution also put on some other witnesses basically trying to show that this was a premeditated act by the Earps and that they had basically kind of almost set him up, I guess, so to speak. In the middle of the prosecution, this is kind of a weird thing too. Now, in the middle of the prosecution's case, and this was on November 7th, so this has been going on, so we started on October 31st, so this is about a week later. For whatever reason, Judge Spicer, and to the surprise of the defendants, revoked Wyatt Earp's and Doc Holliday's bail. And so basically that meant since they were no longer on bail, they were kept in jail at this point. As you can imagine, the prosecution, they were probably just overjoyed. So they're like, oh yeah, we're winning this. The judge must think we're winning it. So he put them into jail. So, I mean, there could be several different reasons why he did this. One could be he's trying to protect Wyatt and Doc Holliday from any kind of thing that might happen to them on the street.
He could have been getting threatened or something.
Or he may have been trying to show he doesn't have any bias for them. You know, he's like, well, I'll just go and put him in jail. So to avoid the appearance of impropriety, he's going to throw him in jail.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. The next day, Earp and Holliday are brought to court from the jail. And Billy, the kid Claiborne, was called to testify the prosecution. Now, I mean, if your name's Billy, I guess you just automatically have the kid after it. Is that the...
Well, this was another one of those things that, you know, all these things came together when we started researching this, that all these things come up. I'm reading this. I'm saying, what? Billy the Kid testified at this trial? And I mean, it sounded right to me, Billy the Kid Claiborne. Well, it ends up basically in history, there were two Billy the Kids. This was number two.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was Billy the Kid. And what happens is through history, a lot of these things have gotten melded together. So they've kind of been cross-pollinated there with each other in some of the stories. Some were one and some were the other. Now, let's go to Billy the Kid number one. Billy the Kid number one was actually born in New York and was a kid of really bad circumstances. He basically didn't have a father. His mother died when he was like about 12. And he had to go about on his own. And he ended up out west trying to make it. He was surrounded by a lot of bad people. He was only like 14 or 15 years old. And he basically became a hired gun. There was a battle that was going on out in Wichita, Kansas. The Logan County Wars. Or Lincoln County Wars. Sorry, had the wrong one. We got them both here, Logan and Lincoln County.
I drove through both today.
Yeah. I was thinking it's Logan, but it's Lincoln County Wars. Lincoln County Wars. And he signed up and was a gunfighter, a hired gun on one of the sides. And yeah, he did kill some people, but it wasn't like he was this notorious. I mean, you think of Billy the Kid, he went around and robbed banks and all this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Billy the Kid was just, he just was in there with these other guys. And actually, he ended up getting captured during this war. And he switched sides. He went over to the other side. The other side said, hey, if you fight for us, we'll let you go. He said, okay. He was a kid. He's like 15 years old. He said, okay. So he shot and, you know, he shot a lot of people. He killed some people, stuff like that. But he wasn't this bad guy. But what happened is they glamorized him, Billy the Kid. And he was this young guy and he was involved in all these things. The newspapers in those days that were just coming of prominence, they saw being able to sell more papers by glamorizing these stories. So every murder that took place in this area, they threw it on Billy the Kid, and they would write that in the paper. So that was how his legend grew. And really, he didn't have anything to do with that. Well, you know, so that was all these tales that came up about him. So he was Billy the Kid, and he ended up getting bushwhacked by Pat Garrett. Just like they said, he walked into a trap. And Pat Garrett was hiding in the shadows and shot him and killed him. Well, this other Billy the Kid Claiborne, people called him Billy the Kid sometimes, but he didn't push that too much. Now, this guy was a loudmouth. He wanted to promote his image that he was this big, tough guy. And he would start fights and he would go around and shoot some people and stuff like that. But but he wasn't really a bad character. Like, I mean, he hadn't really been involved in all things like the real Billy the Kid had.
Yeah.
But after the first Billy the Kid died, then he insisted that everybody call him Billy the Kid. Now, he was afraid before that the real Billy the Kid would come after him.
Yeah.
So he didn't say much. Once the real Billy the Kid was dead, then he started insisting everybody call him Billy the Kid. If you didn't call him Billy the Kid, then he would shoot you. He ended up getting shot by a guy named Frank Leslie, who will come up again later. He ended up getting shot by Frank Leslie, who killed him because he had challenged him. He came in drunk and challenged him to a gunfight, and he got killed. But this Billy the Kid was a completely different character. But a lot of times their stories get intermingled.
For the next witness for the prosecution, they decided to call Ike Clanton, the brother, and the one guy from the other side of the gunfight who survived. And as you can imagine, he might not have been the most credible witness to call to the stand.
No, I think he probably had some favoritism involved since his brother and two friends had been gunned down.
So basically, he said that his brother was gunned down by Morgan Earp as his hands were thrown up about even with the level of his head. Split seconds later, Ike took Wyatt Earp's pistol-holding hand with my left hand, grabbed him around by the shoulder with my right hand, and pushed him around the corner, allowing Ike to duck into the safety of the photograph gallery. So basically, he's saying that he grabbed Wyatt Earp while he's holding a pistol and trying to make an arrest. So, you know, that really didn't...
Match the rest of the situation.
Yeah, and also, it probably wouldn't have helped his story either. I mean, if they're law officers and they're trying to disarm you and you start grabbing at them, Is that going to help the situation?
Absolutely not.
So basically, during the cross-examination, this is another reason maybe you did not want to call Clanton to the stand to not subject him to cross-examination, but Fitch basically forced Ike to admit that he had actually been carrying the Winchester rifle around Tombstone in the morning of the gunfight. So that, you know, that probably did not bode well for his case because, once again, carrying a rifle around in Tombstone was against the law. It was against that town ordinance. That was basically the prosecution's case. That's who they put on. I mean, there's some other people too, but that's the kind of the highlights of it.
So they had nothing but dubious witnesses.
Pretty much. And Fitch had basically impeached them all.
Or torn them all apart.
Yep, shot them to pieces. The defense opened up their case. And this is kind of a strange thing in a preliminary hearing because usually the defense does not actually call any witnesses in this instance. It's more of a chance for the defense to kind of get a peek at the prosecution's case. You don't want to give away your hand about what your case is going to be. They basically called Wyatt Earp. Now, the weird thing about the law at this time, and this must have been something that happened more frequently in this day and age, is that there was an Arizona law which allowed defendants in a preliminary hearing to not be cross-examined by basically just offering a narrative statement. And so basically what Earp did is he just read an account of events as what took place. So, I mean, this was probably written by his lawyer for him to read.
So he just read a statement in as what happened and got off the stand.
Yeah.
And that was it.
You can't ask him questions because it's the loophole, I guess, an exception. Basically, according to his statement, the McLaurys had been waiting for a chance to get even ever since. And he recounted a couple different threats that he'd received from the McLaurys over the year. Basically, going back to that first one we talked about earlier. Basically, he said that Clanton's accusation was a tissue of lies from beginning to end. So in Earp's narrative statement, he basically portrayed the shooting as the unfortunate result of Behan's deceiving them into thinking that he had disarmed the Clantons and the McLaurys. And he said that basically only when he realized that his party was within close range of the men did he realize that they actually had their six shooters in plain sight. He testified that the shooting began when, in response to Virgil's demand that they disarm, Billy and Frank reached for their guns. And Earp claimed to have, along with Billy Clanton, fired one of the first two shots of the gunfight. He just kind of told a story in his narrative that it was self-defense. They were lawmen enforcing the laws, since carrying the guns violated the Tombstone Ordinance, and they were forced to make the tough split-second decision to fire before it was too late to save themselves. So basically, it was them or us. They were breaking the law, and we had only a second to make this decision. After Wyatt had testified, they called Virgil to the stand, which is kind of strange because he was actually not on the stand, but the court went to his bedside at the Cosmopolitan Hotel. Because he was still recovering from the gunshot wound that he took.
So they get the sympathy vote there, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. this is one of the guys who was a lawman who was wounded. You know, I mean, he played to the judge.
Yeah.
So, and he of course, backed his brother. You always back your brother, Wyatt.
Absolutely.
And he basically said that followed Wyatt's story. So the defense put on some other witnesses. One of the most compelling things was there were several other witnesses who basically testified they heard Sheriff Johnny Behan tell Virgil, "You did perfectly right," allegedly he had said. So, you know, it kind of contradicted Behan's decision or Behan's testimony as to what he thought about took place. So,
well, they also had testimony from another fellow that was there, and he said, "Ike Clanton threatened the morning of the shootout that as soon as the Earps and Doc Holliday showed themselves on the street, the ball would open. Fight is my racket, and all I want is 4 feet of ground." So I don't know exactly what that terminology means, but I guess it means that 4 feet of ground means he's going to shoot him.
And he had a racket, and he was going to get a shuttlecock, and they were going to have 4 feet of ground to play badminton.
You think that's it?
I don't know. Well, the testimony basically ended on November 29th, 30 witnesses, and then Judge Spicer had to make a decision. And his decision was a verdict, which was almost a total victory for the defense. And basically he held that there would be no criminal trial of the Earps or Holliday. He's basically said that he considered their decision to have Holliday help with disarming the Clantons and McLaurys was probably not a good decision. That Holliday had a reputation for violence
and being a hothead.
And additionally, there was a well-known beef between them as well. So it was kind of saying like, you know, you shouldn't have brought him. It was really stupid that you did. But there was no criminal act for doing this, and you were just basically enforcing the law. Basically, the tragic results of the Clanton and McLaurys' actions were largely their own fault. And he said, "I cannot resist the conclusion that the defendants were fully justified in committing these homicides. There being no sufficient cause to believe the defendants guilty of murder, I order them to be released." So proverbial crap hit the fan after this took place.
Oh, yeah. Half the group was upset and the other half was happy.
And what's interesting is there are two newspapers in this small town. One was called the Tombstone Epitaph, and they had nothing but praise for Spicer. And then the aforementioned Tombstone Nugget called the decision contemptible. So we have, not only do you have two different sides, you have two different newspapers.
Now, here comes the part after this that I have never heard of before. You have, about a month later, Virgil Earp was ambushed by several men, probably including Ike Clanton, as he walked home from a saloon, and two loads of buckshot he was hit with, and it left his left arm virtually unusable for the rest of his life. Then, about a week later, Morgan Earp was basically assassinated. He was playing pool and was shot through the window of the saloon in a bullet that severed his spine. And as he fell to the ground, he laid there and looked up at the people that were in there and said, I guess this is the last game of pool I'll ever play.
Yeah.
And he died. Well, this launched, for Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday, the Vendetta Ride. They go out and they go track down all these people that were involved and shoot them one at a time. Some of them, they're not sure who shot who, but all you know is they ended up dead, and the Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday were still standing.
Yeah. And then Wyatt Earp, as the epilogue in Tombstone is that he ended up marrying Josephine. What was it? They moved to San Francisco, where it was said they were to have prospered in dry goods or something like that.
Well, they went to San Francisco, then to Idaho, then to El Paso, and to Alaska. But anyway, he lived until the age of 80 and died in 1929.
Wow.
I mean, when you think about this OK Corral, and you think about that way back in time, 1929 was less than 3 decades before I was born.
Yeah.
So it's not that big a separation, and that just blows my mind that it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, 19, I mean, they're, yeah. That's
1929, and this guy was still around. He did all kinds of various things after that. He refereed prize fights. Evidently, that was a thing that guys like that got into. Doc Holliday did that a little bit, too, because he wasn't sure what to do after a while. No, I take that back. It was Bat Masterson that did that.
Yeah.
Because he lived for a long time, too. Doc Holliday only lived to be 36.
Yeah, well, the story goes that he had tuberculosis.
Yeah, his mother died of tuberculosis, and him and his adopted brother actually both came down with tuberculosis at an early age. And Doc Holliday was actually a dentist. He was trained. His uncle, I think it was, started a university that something to do with dentistry or something, and so he followed in his footsteps, became a dentist. But he had undiagnosed tuberculosis at the time, even though his mother died of it. He didn't realize he had it. So he had a hard time practicing dentistry because he'd be racked by these convulsive coughs while he was trying to do it. So that kind of cut down on his clientele. So when he finally figured out that he had tuberculosis, that's one of the reasons he moved out west. He was actually from Georgia. And he moved out west because they said the dry, temperate weather would be better for him. So he moved out there for that reason. And that's kind of the reason he became the gunslinger he was. I mean, he was a bad dude. He killed a lot of people. A lot of these things are glamorized. They tell all these tales of the ones that they shot a lot of people and stuff. Doc Holliday was a bad dude. He shot a lot of people. But he didn't think he had any time to live. I mean, he and his stepbrother came down with tuberculosis about the same time, and his stepbrother died by the time he was 20. Mm-hmm. So as far as Doc Holliday was concerned, he was on borrowed time anyway. He didn't really care.
He was mean. He was too mean to die.
He'd fight anybody, anywhere, anytime. It didn't matter. In the movie there where he's sitting there under the tree and he says, I was looking for Wyatt Earp. And what does Doc Holliday tell him?
I'm your Huckleberry.
Yeah. He didn't have nothing to lose. He didn't care. And there's still not to this day, nobody really knows who killed Johnny Ringo, who was another guy that was real. I just thought that was a character from, you know, Johnny Ringo was a TV series.
Why, Johnny Ringo, he looked like somebody just walked over your grave.
You know, he was a real guy, and that was from a TV series, too, from that same time frame. It was like 1959 or 60, something like that.
Yeah, I never heard of that one.
And what they did in that, though, they completely took license with it. They said he was a gunslinger that then became the sheriff and was a good guy and was protecting the town. Well, Johnny Ringo was just a gunfighter.
Yeah.
But there's stories that say Wyatt Earp killed him. There's stories that say Doc Holliday killed him. But the real story is John Leslie, who killed Billy the Kid number 2, was actually on Billy the Kid when he was dying from being shot by John Leslie. He said John Leslie killed Johnny Ringo. I was there and I saw him.
Huh.
So who knows? It's all mixed up. They were all there at one time. It is all incredible.
We didn't have a trial, though, to get all the colorful testimony about who killed Johnny Ringo, though.
I don't think anybody cared.
Yeah.
They found him days after he was dead, kind of hanging through the fork of a tree.
Found an unclaimed piece of meat down in Baja. Might have been Johnny Ringo.
Could have been. But, I mean, all these characters that came about in one time frame, and they all converged on the same era, in the same area at the same time. And a lot of these people, you know, you don't know, are they myths? Are they stories? Are they real? And they all came about. And it was just incredible to do this research and find these things.
So now it comes down to, what is the best movie about the shootout at the OK Corral?
Well, the two that came out 1 year apart were Wyatt Earp, that had Kevin Costner in it.
Yep.
I can't remember who else was in there, but it had Kevin Costner played Wyatt Earp.
Yep.
And then the other one was Tombstone.
Yes.
Had Kurt Russell, Sam Elliott.
Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer. Now, you can say what you want about Val Kilmer. I don't know. He might be having problems these days. You know, they've shown these pictures and make fun of him. But Val Kilmer in that movie, he was an excellent Doc Holliday. I thought he was great. I love Kurt Russell and Sam Elliott. I'm partial to them already. They're two of my favorite actors ever. And I also, especially Sam Elliott, because there have been some roles that I've had where people said I favor Sam Elliott, so I got to like the guy.
Tombstone also had Bill Paxton. He played Morgan Earp and Powers Booth.
Yeah.
So
had a lot of good people.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But that Tombstone is by far my favorite. I mean, that one just, it doesn't go into a lot of these details like we gave here, but, you know, that scene where Doc Holliday kills Johnny Ringo, who's played by the guy from Terminator.
Yeah.
Michael Biehn, I think is his name.
Oh, Michael Biehn.
Biehn. Biehn.
Yeah, that guy's played like a Navy SEAL in about seven movies, too, I think.
Yeah.
So the Wyatt Earp movie had Kevin Costner, Dennis Quaid as Doc Holliday.
Yeah, Dennis Quaid, that's right.
Gene Hackman was in it, Michael Madsen, Mark Harmon. So there was a lot of good actors in that one, too.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, to me, it's not even a question. Tombstone is so much better.
It is, but I enjoy the story. I like watching both of them, but I would go for Tombstone over Wyatt Earp. That's got to be the best one.
No doubt. And I think it's better than the classic shootout at the OK Corral, the one with whoever was in that old one. I don't know.
Whoever those guys were.
Yeah.
Sydney's got that poster Tombstone hanging outside the door here of the studio.
Yeah, I know. I was just saying that. We walk right outside, and it's like there's a Tombstone poster.
That's one of her favorite movies ever.
That's one of the movies actually I owned when I was in college. It came out, I think, when I was a freshman in college. And we watched it on soccer road trips over and over and over again.
It can't be beat.
Now it's time for
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is where we go over some of the different terms, which generally legal terms, which we discussed during the show. And we just see if we can remember what they mean.
And we mean meaning me.
That also helps reinforce for all of our listeners, too, what they mean, if you're not familiar with it, because you got to reinforce these things.
That's right, because we've thrown a lot at you, so we want to make sure you are on your toes.
So the first...
Partner.
Don't be on those spurs. Get on your toes. The first term is preliminary hearing.
Preliminary hearing is the hearing that they hold to determine if there is enough evidence to proceed to a jury trial.
That's correct. Justice of the peace.
Justice of the peace was a term for a lower level judge. That's sort of similar to a magistrate.
Yep. They basically handle kind of the smaller cases and also make these determinations at these preliminary hearings or probable cause hearings to determine if there's enough evidence to make it go to trial.
All right. Now, I've got one for you.
All right.
What does it mean when you buffalo a guy?
That's where you invite a friend over to have dinner, and you tell them that you're just going to have steak for dinner, but instead you serve them really, really hot buffalo wings, and you say, "You just got buffaloed."
Wrong. That's not it.
It's whacking somebody over the head with your hog leg. By hog leg, we mean pistol.
Back to Josie Wales, one of my favorite lines is when he says, "You know, that's the way it is. When I get to liking somebody, they ain't around long." And the old Indian says,
"Yeah, I notice when." Go ahead.
Go ahead.
"I notice when you get to disliking somebody, they ain't around much neither."
I think the Earps were kind of like that.
Yeah.
When they got to disliking you, or Doc Holliday, when they got to disliking you, you weren't around long.
You were in trouble. Well, I had a lot of fun doing our Wild West themed podcast.
Yeah, it was a little bit out of the ordinary, but it had some interesting facts and some interesting trivia. And it was fun to do. And I learned a lot. I hope you did too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of strange trivia that took place. And I mean, I knew you'd enjoy this because given your proclivity for the Wild Wild West, it was a no-brainer.
Well, and then it turned into all these Forrest Gumps wandering around through periods of history and being in the same place at the same time. And I thought, no, it can't be. Billy the Kid, he was there as a witness. How did these things happen? And then find out there's two Billy the Kids. You know, you never know. But this Billy the Kid, he wasn't a good one. He turned around and ran when the stuff hit the fan.
That's right. Well, it's time for us to ride off into the sunset.
All right, partner, we're going to mosey on along, and we'll catch you on the other side or something.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I am...